I expect that there's an episode or two from your own personal history where you did something that was totally against the odds. Most of us do, I think. You know, something that you did that just seemed hugely unlikely, where people tried to talk you out of it, but they couldn't, and you proved them wrong. For me, these episodes, they were all minor. A schoolyard fight against a bigger guy when I was 7 or 8. There was also a couple of sporting achievements that meant absolutely nothing, but of course were major to me because some jerk sports teacher had written me off. And eventually at college, I was written off again, and I bounced back. They're personal motivators that mean the world to me and nothing to anyone else. I haven't saved a life. I haven't given a refugee kid a new chance. I haven't created transformative art. I haven't helped bring a language back from the dead. But that last one, bringing a language back from the dead, I know someone who has.
The word in words is ni possible in part by National Endowment from the humanity celebrate 15 years of excellence.
Darryl Baldwin ignored the people who told him it's too late to save the language of his ancestors. Don't get me wrong, those people, they were talking sense. On the face of it, it was too late. Too late for Darryl's language and maybe thousands of other languages. But I guess he likes a challenge. And one key thing here, he's had help from friends, from other members of his Native American tribe, from academia, foundations, even the US government, eventually. He's not alone. And that's big. One other quick note before I turn Darryl's story over to reporter Carol Zoll. There are more than one Miamis. There's, you know, the one that people sing and rap about. Miami, Florida. The name, it derives from a Native American tribe. That is not the Miami in today's pod. No beaches, no mojitos. No, we're headed inland to a different Miami, or series of Miamis. If you've ever heard of the Miami of Oklahoma, or Indiana, or Ohio, or anywhere else in the landlocked middle of America, that's who we're talking about. The Miami Native American Nation. Nothing to do with the Florida tribe. They just ended up with the same name once things got bastardized into English. This is the Miami starring in today's pod. The people, a group of activists, all of them strangely born the same year, and their ancestral language, Miamia. Okay, here's Carol Zoll.
The last native speaker of Miamia died in the 1960s. Before that, the language had been in bad shape for decades. The Miami people had been forcibly relocated twice in the 19th century, and they ended up scattered throughout the Midwest. So even 100 years ago, there weren't that many speakers. By the 1980s, everyone thought the language was dead. But then Darryl Baldwin came along. The way Darryl tells it, he'd always known he had Miamia heritage. But it wasn't until his late 20s that he got interested in the language.
I remember very specifically, right around 1989, 1990, stumbling across these language materials, several pages of what I believed to be was Miamia language.
The stuff Darryl found had belonged to his grandfather.
I had no idea where it came from. There wasn't any information of where he got it from. But it was probably my first real exposure to the language.
A lot was happening in Darryl Baldwin's life at the time. He'd been working in construction for 10 years, but now, in his late 20s, he'd gone back to school to get a college degree. His wife was expecting their first child. Despite all that, Darryl decided to devote some time to trying to find out more about his tribe's language.
My grandfather had since passed, but my father was alive, so I asked him if he knew anything about the language, and he said no, that he didn't. He said I should probably try to check in both Indiana and Oklahoma to see if there were any speakers left. And it was during one of those trips that I bumped into or was introduced to a young man by the name of David Costa, who also was visiting Indiana to see if there were any speakers left of this language.
David Costa. We're going to leave Darryl here for a moment and talk about David, because like Darryl, he's an integral part of this story. In fact, without him, you could say, there wouldn't be a story. When he and Darryl met in the early 90s, David was a linguistics grad student at UC Berkeley.
No one knew if there were speakers anymore.
In 1988, David had finished a master's degree in linguistics and was looking around for a dissertation topic. He was 26 years old and didn't really know what to focus on. But his advisor specialized in Algonquian languages. That's the language family that Miamia, or Miami, Illinois, as linguists call it, belongs to.
No one knew how many materials there were. No one knew what the language was like. Just they knew that there were some materials, and it at least used to be there, and there was a Miami tribe.
David's advisor suggested he start digging around to see what he could find. Maybe there was enough material for a dissertation. So he started looking and was amazed by what he found.
There was a vast amount of written records on the language, like more than most Algonquian languages have, but nothing had been published, or almost nothing.
He started spending time in archives, the Smithsonian, the Indiana State Library. The more he looked, the more he found documents that had never seen the light of day.
They'd just been sitting in the archive for 100 to 110 years, you know? And I basically was finding new data sources practically every year for several years.
Eventually, David would find three large dictionaries of the Miami language dating back to the 16 and 1700s, treasure troves of information about the language that had been compiled by French missionaries. After his initial burst of finding material in the archives, David wanted to know if there was anyone left who still spoke the language. He'd heard a rumor that there was someone in Oklahoma, a man named Woody Palmer. The more David tells the story, the more excited he gets.
In 1988, I spoke with a couple people who had met him and who said he spoke Miami, and apparently he was even told that there was this young linguist out in Berkeley who was working on the language.
In 1989, David went to Oklahoma to see if he could find Woody Palmer, but it was too late. Palmer had died.
To this day, no one has any idea whether he really spoke. He could have spoke, and I could have missed out on something enormous, or it could be that he knew about 10 words. There's no way to know. He passed away a couple months before I went out there.
So, dead end, literally. But David didn't give up. A few years later, he went back to look for more speakers, this time in Indiana. He couldn't find any, but he did meet some people from the Miami tribe, which brings us back to Darryl Baldwin.
I'd met Darryl at a powwow in Indiana, like for about 5 minutes, you know.
By this point, Darryl and his wife Karen had started teaching themselves Miamia.
And he was trying to sort of teach himself the language from the sort of scanty materials that were circulating, and he only had the dimmest idea that there was anybody, or maybe no idea, that there was someone in California who was already roping this stuff together.
So, David says, when he finished his dissertation on the Miamia language, he sent Darryl a copy.
I sent him my dissertation cold in 1995. I just packaged it up and said, here, maybe this would help. Maybe, you know, this might be of interest to you.
By now, Darryl and Karen Baldwin had two small children, and not only were they trying to learn the language, they were also trying to teach it to their kids. They didn't have a dictionary. There was no Teach Yourself Miamia book. There were no sound recordings of the language. And no one knew about the archival materials that David Costa had uncovered. Darryl says their efforts were pretty basic.
It started with words, things I was interested in, household items, and we would literally tape up new words around the house. And so whether it was dishes, whether it was food items, whether it was furniture, we would go around the house and tape up little pieces of paper that had words written on it.
But, he says, they could only go so far with that approach. And then he got David's dissertation in the mail.
I thought, wow, I'm really going to learn a lot about my language. And I peeled open that thing, I looked at it, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have no clue what he's talking about here.
The dissertation was full of academic jargon, discussions of things like vowel length and accent retraction, terminology that meant nothing to Darryl.
I remember closing it and thinking, oh my gosh, there's no way I can make use of this. And I knew at that point that if I was going to ever really make use of David's work, I was going to have to get some training in linguistics. And that is at that time that I decided to go into the linguistics program.
So that's what happened. Because of that dissertation, Darryl Baldwin got a master's in linguistics. He wrote his thesis on the grammar of Miami, Illinois. He didn't want to be a linguist. He just wanted to be able to learn his language. From then on, Darryl and David were in touch a lot. They became friends.
And I was just pleased to have a second human being in the world that was interested in this language, you know.
As Darryl learned more about the language, he and his wife Karen ramped up their efforts. When their kids got old enough for school, Karen, who was a high school teacher, quit her job so she could homeschool the kids in Miamia.
We started with kinship terms, Nusa, Inga, Aya greeting terms. I made games and posters and songs, and we wrote poems and wrote stories and journaled in as much language as we could, you name it. I pulled every trick out of the hat that I could find.
People started noticing what the Baldwins were doing. And it turned out some other members of the tribe were also studying the language, memorizing word lists and things like that. Darryl started sharing what he knew with the others.
I think that was the first time I really began to feel like I wasn't alone in this. And so we began to do regular activities during the summer on an annual basis.
Eventually, things became more official. In 1997, the Miami tribe got a grant from the Administration for Native Americans, a federal agency that supports Native American communities. The grant was for language revitalization.
A position came open with this grant, language clerk.
This is Julie Olds, another Miami tribe member.
And I thought, you know, that sounds interesting. I'd like to do that.
Julie Olds was born in 1962, the same year that Darryl and Karen Baldwin and David Costa were born. They all joke that there's something special about that year. Julie was raised with a strong sense of connection to the tribe. Her grandmother had even known some of the language, but was forced to go to one of the government-run boarding schools for Native Americans.
She had two sisters. And when they sent them away to boarding school, they did not send them to the same place. So Aunt Mary was sent to Carlisle in Pennsylvania, Aunt Jo was sent to Riverside in California, and Grandma was sent to Haskell in Kansas. And all those miles apart. And that was with intent. That was an intent to break up that family unit, to break up the sharing of family knowledge and any use of language. And so that's what happened, you know, in our family.
So Julie didn't grow up with the language. It stopped with her grandmother. But when that language clerk position came open in 1997, she went for it. And one of the first things that happened was that her boss told her to get in touch with a couple of people.
She said, I need you to work with these two people that we've identified for the grant. One is this Miami fellow. He lives in Missoula, Montana. His name's Darryl Baldwin. And then the other one is this David Costa. He's out in California.
Julie called me one day and said, would you like to serve as an instructor on this grant that we have?
Julie, Darryl, and David all talk about the grant as a turning point for the language. It wasn't the actual project that was important.
You know, we did a small little dictionary booklet and things like that.
It brought the three of them together as a team for the first time.
I think it was David's work in linguistics and the reconstruction of the language, my passion for language learning in the home, and Julie's passion to bring language to back to the community that really kind of came together and I think really launched this.
Okay, so Carol, before the discovery of all of those language materials in the archives, what did people actually know about Miamia?
Well, you know, of course, the tribe members themselves knew that there had been a language, and up into the 1970s and even the 1980s, there were some people who still knew a few words, but a lot had been lost. And there was also a lot of misinformation about the language. So David Costa, the linguist, told me that there were books, for instance, about the Miami tribe that had been published as late as the 1960s that were really appalling.
There is a book out that said something like the Miami language had only about 200 words. You know, it's like one step better than being told your language is grunts or something like that, you know. It, you know, had no grammar, that kind of thing, you know. Just absolute nonsense that was still being perpetuated remarkably recently. And this was in a book. And this was in a book that last I heard was still, until quite recently, or maybe is still, sometimes used in public schools in Indiana. There was no knowledge of how incredibly sophisticated and complex and complicated and fascinating these languages are.
So there was a lot of ignorance. And David even said to me that one of the reasons why this project appealed to him was because, quote, I liked the idea of working on a language that no one knew anything about.
Hmm. And you also said something earlier on about how there are no sound recordings to this language. So when Darryl and Karen Baldwin, when they started to practice this language, where did they go to try and figure out how to pronounce it?
Yeah, exactly. I wondered about that too. The thing is, there are Algonquian languages that didn't die out. So basically, they have to triangulate. They use the written sources and they compare them with the closest known languages like Kickapoo or Ojibwe to figure out what the pronunciation should be. And, you know, they don't get too hung up on it, actually, but they do hope that maybe someday a recording will turn up in somebody's attic somewhere. You know, and another interesting thing about pronunciation is that as David Costa and the others have methodically worked their way through these hundreds of pages of old documents, sometimes they've realized they've been mistaken in what they thought they knew about this language and how to speak it.
Words, phrases, pronunciations, you name it, sometimes we have to unlearn it and learn something new. And that can be very frustrating. It is very frustrating.
George Ironstrack is one of a younger generation of Miamia speakers. At 40, he's been learning the language since he was a teenager. He says the first word he remembers having to unlearn was the word for no. He'd learned it from an old word list as muche, but when he attended a class, he was told that was wrong, that it should really be pronounced motse.
So then I changed my pronunciation to motse, and then some years later, with enough other examples of pronunciation, we learned that it was in fact muche. And so then I had to change again, back again, to the way I'd learned it phonetically from this older document. That's just one example. It happens multiple places.
The early days of learning the language were full of challenges and stumbles like that. But a lot has changed since then. One of the biggest changes is that in 2001, Darrell Baldwin was hired to start the Miamia Project, a joint effort between the Miami Tribe and Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. The project, which has since morphed into the Miamia Center, has become the de facto headquarters for the effort to revive Miami language and culture. And it's a powerhouse. The center's 7 staff members create the kind of materials that didn't exist when Darrell was trying to learn the language. They also run workshops for tribal members all over the U.S. They research the tribe's traditions, they maintain an online dictionary, all sorts of stuff. Darrell is the center's director, and David is in charge of language research. Another big change is that today, there are a lot more people involved with the language.
Just off the top of my head and just guessing, there's easily 500 people that are using the Miamia language on a regular basis, even if it is just a word or two.
That may not sound like a lot, but Darrell says it's significant.
Because 25 years ago, there was no language used, very little to no language used.
A lot of the new speakers are young. Some have come through Miami University, where tribal members are eligible for free tuition. These students have become a big part of the revitalization effort. But as Julie Olds remembers, their role wasn't obvious at first.
You know, in early years when I used to come up here, I would always ask to get to meet with our tribal students attending. And, you know, I think there may be 6 of them at the time. And we would get them together, and they didn't have anything to talk about. You know, and they barely even knew each other.
So Darrell and his colleagues created what's now called the Heritage Course, a series of classes that all tribal students would attend.
And now because of the Heritage class, there's just this fire. And these young people, they're learning all about who they are as Miami people, and they're learning their language. And it's becoming this very personal identity. It's changing us. It's completely changing us.
This year, there are 32 tribal students on campus, the biggest group ever. And unlike the early years, these students do know each other. Karen Baldwin says she attends the classes once or twice a semester.
And what struck me this year, when I walked into the classroom, the level of excitement and enthusiasm and just simply noise level was absolutely amazing. These students were yelling at each other across the room. They were hugging each other. They were running to each other. They were high-fiving. It was just amazing.
Karen started to choke up here. The changes she's seen in the community have been so profound, it was hard for her to talk about.
So when you see things like that, you think, something is happening here.
One of the tribal students currently on campus is Megan Mooney.
I did not grow up with any context of the Miamia tribe at all. And like the closest I ever got to it was like a fourth and eighth grade like projects and social studies about Native Americans. And I'd like ask my mom, like, aren't we in a tribe? Like, what was the name of the tribe?
Megan says she finally remembered the name of the tribe when her sister applied to college.
My older sister, Jackie, applied to this place called Miami University. I was like, huh, okay, why is that place named that? And it's like, oh, the Miami tribe, we're in it. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Megan is majoring in English with a minor in Spanish. She says she's learning Miamia words and phrases, but isn't conversational yet.
But every now and then I can, like, look at the weather and say, ah, sande ke, like, it's sunny outside, or, you know, I can say hello and stuff like that. And the more I learn in the language, basically the more I want to learn. And it's definitely changed how I feel about my identity, because first I was just like this little Caucasian, that's how I saw myself, and now I identify as Native. And so that's how it's influenced me in my life.
Megan is just one student. But Julie Old says that everyone in the Miamia community has felt the impact of the tribe's language work.
They have never seen it the way it is now. You know, I was talking to tribal leaders the other day, and I said, you know, none of us can remember it being like this, ever. And I've talked to elders about it, too, and they don't remember. And that's what makes them so happy. They feel so good that the tribe's always going to be here now. They know that it is, because there's just this just tightly woven family unit, and it's very broad. It's immeasurable. And so we have a healing that began with the return of language, and it's given us back our life.
It's April 2016, and Daryl Baldwin is kicking off the 7th Biennial Miamiaki Conference. It's a gathering that showcases the Miamia Center's work and brings tribal members together in the same place for a few days.
I began learning to speak my language sometime in my late 20s.
Standing on stage in a large lecture hall, Daryl addresses an audience of a few hundred people. He's wearing a suit jacket over a plaid button-down shirt with a silver ornament around his neck, a replica of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma seal. His hair is pulled back into a single braid.
Before we begin, I'd like to invite Chacha, Chachenza, Chingwea, to come up and open with a song.
On stage, Daryl's oldest son, Jared, who's now 26, sings in Miamia, along with two other men. They're all dressed in jeans, but Jared also wears a loose black top with traditional Miamia ribbon work. Red, white, and yellow ribbons fall from his shoulders and waist. They sing in the language for 3 minutes. There are also several hundred people watching a live stream of the conference. The energy in the room is palpable. There's a sense of reverence for the language and customs that are being brought back, but also a feeling of celebration. Between talks on things like Miamia ecology and Miamia Montessori education, there are breaks when people chat and check out stalls at the back of the room featuring traditional crafts. Later tonight, there'll be a big community dinner.
We feel so confident that we're going to be okay as Miamia people. We're going to be okay.
These days, Julie Olds is the tribe's cultural resources officer.
You know, in the beginning, we had to clear all the weeds of years and years of language dormancy and loss. Because when there's a language dormancy, there's typically cultural dormancy as well. And so we identified our garden space, did our best to clear the weeds, you know, and to start planting those seeds again. And tomorrow and many, many years in the future, it's going to continue to grow.
So has Miamia been revived? It's complicated. The forces that were unleashed by a series of chance encounters and decisions, Daryl Baldwin finding his grandfather's word lists, David Costa uncovering forgotten manuscripts, Daryl and David's meeting at a powwow, Karen and Daryl's decision to raise their kids with the language, that grant that brought Julie, David, and Daryl together, all of that has changed the Miamia tribe in a really big way. Things are different now. And the language is part of people's lives in a way that it wasn't 30 years ago. But none of the people I spoke to, not even Daryl Baldwin, considers themselves to be fluent in the language. And Daryl says the way ahead won't be easy.
But we do what all generations have done. We do the very best we can with what we have.
He says they won't bring back the language overnight. But there's a generation coming now, including Daryl's own young granddaughter, that hasn't known the tribe not to have language.
The hardest thing is patience for an effort like this. You know, we represented a community that you didn't want to become. And some were as bold as to say that once you lost your language, you ceased to exist as Native people. And how powerful and, in my mind, harming is that kind of language for a community like ours. So it's taken a long time for us to be confident about what we're doing and to know through our own experiences that languages don't necessarily die when the last speaker passes. And for communities that are trying to reclaim their language from documentation, they have a right to do that. And it will be a very powerful experience for them. And their communities will benefit immensely through the work of language reclamation.
At the end of the conference, there's a stomp dance, a tradition among some Native American tribes. The dance starts with just a few people in the middle of a room, walking around a small artificial fire. Most are Shawnee and absentee Shawnee, tribes related to the Miamia. The Shawnee men wear wide-brimmed black or white hats. The women wear long, brightly decorated skirts and have cans attached to their legs that make a shaking sound as they stomp. Soon, Miamia people join in. They all walk around in a circle, singing and stomping. As they continue, more people get up and join them, college students or curious members of the public, wearing jeans, baseball caps, t-shirts, leggings. Some look like they know what they're doing. Others seem a bit uncertain. They walk and they march and they stomp. More and more people join the dance, and the circle gets bigger and bigger.
Carol Zoll, she's a reporter based here in Boston and a regular on the pod. We have photos that Carol took of pretty much everyone she talked to. Also, since Carol was in Ohio, Daryl Baldwin got some exciting news. The MacArthur Foundation, you know, the people who award those so-called genius grants, well, they gave Daryl one. It's $625,000 paid out over the course of 5 years, no strings attached. But let's be real, it's been awarded to help him continue to reclaim Miamia. And of course, it comes with a ton of prestige and publicity. This is the kind of help for North American languages that wasn't really there a couple of generations ago. But also what wasn't there were people like Daryl making the choices that they did. Miamia, in whatever form it survives, is the better for it and for them. If you like this episode, we have quite a few others that we've done this year on language revitalization in its many different forms. We have episodes on Shinnecock, Hawaiian, Ainu, Irish, and others. Coming later this year, Lakota, Frisian, and Ekegusi. Also, wherever you hear this podcast, please give us a review. It helps others find us. If you use Facebook, there's a World in Words page. You can contact us there. And we're on Twitter. The pod is at LingoPod, and I'm Patry Cox, PatriCox. Thanks for listening. We'll be back very soon.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.